In Canada, what began as a narrow movement of truckers against a vaccine requirement has widened to include white nationalists and conspiracy theorists.
Everybody in the far right is involved in this thing. Every bad apple in Canada is involved.
The Canadian convoy has also sparked a copycat movement across Europe. Protesters there have converged on Brussels today, many coming from France.
Donc c'est pas ça la vie. La vie c'est...
This woman is unvaccinated and says, what kind of life is this? Life is where you're free from total authority. I'm Marco Werman, and the crowd pleaser for Olympians on Ice, Ravel's Bolero. It's been a fave for figure skaters because Bolero has it all.
Driving rhythm, sinewy melody, and steady, dramatic growth.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Monday. For a long time, far-right groups have had trouble getting traction in Canada. That is until 2 weeks ago when they joined the so-called Freedom Convoy, truckers rolling across Canada, destination Ottawa, with their message against COVID vaccination requirements. What started out as a narrow protest has now grown into a movement of people expressing a range of grievances against the government. Anita Elash reports from Toronto.
God help that you could just switch sides and recognize what's going on.
When police tried to clear protesters from a park in Ottawa last week, the protesters turned on them. They were led by evangelical preacher Henry Hildebrandt.
People, think about what's happening in this country. Sir, look at
Hildebrandt leads a parish in Ontario's Bible Belt. He's refused to comply with COVID restrictions since the start of the pandemic. He maintains that the support he gets is the sign of an apocalyptic prophecy. As a crowd gathered around him in Ottawa, the police tactical unit backed off.
Freedom, sir. Stand up for your freedom, sir. Stand up for your freedom.
Hildebrandt is just one of the controversial figures playing a leading role at the protests. Experts say the organizers include members of the religious right, conspiracy theorists, white nationalists, and anti-democratic agitators. Evan Balgord is founder of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, a nonprofit that monitors hate groups in Canada.
Everybody in the far right is involved in this thing. Every bad apple in Canada is involved.
Balgord has been tracking hate groups in Canada since 2015, when a series of Islamophobic acts stunned many Canadians. He says the truckers' protest has given extremists their biggest platform ever.
The far right has more access to money thanks to this, more access to a megaphone and media, more access to new people to radicalize than they've ever had in Canada before.
The protests caught most Canadians off guard, including the government and the police. But Jared Wesley, who studies political culture at the University of Alberta, says the populist anti-government sentiment behind the Freedom Convoy has been percolating for years.
I think it's a mistake to think about this as being, you know, a sudden event.
He says the convoys were fueled by a growing sentiment among some middle-class Canadians that they're getting left behind.
They've been feeling threatened for a while, and there's a palpable sense that, you know, mainstream politicians and political parties don't seem to get that and don't want to get that.
The number of far-right sympathizers is still very small, but Balgord estimates it has grown tenfold in the last 2 years, and everyone's frustration with the pandemic has only emboldened people.
We are all quite afraid. And we're all quite afraid because we've kind of seen how this trajectory has been going over the last several years. It is a fundamental threat to our actual democracy.
Some mainstream politicians have also supported the protesters.
Together, we will make Canadians the freest people on earth.
That's Pierre Poilievre, a leading member of the Federal Conservative Party. He and several other conservative politicians took selfies with the protesters. Poilievre even brought them coffee and donuts. Last week, he announced that he would run for prime minister and promised to address many of the protesters' concerns.
Freedom to raise your kids with your values. Freedom to make your own health and vaccine choices. Freedom to speak without fear and freedom to worship God in your own way.
The next election is likely still 3 or 4 years away. Just long enough, Balgord says, for a far-right movement to take a firmer hold on Canadian politics. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
At the Winter Olympics in Beijing, Russian figure skater Kamila Valieva has been given the green light to compete in tomorrow's events. That's even though she tested positive for a banned heart medication before the Olympics. The Court of Arbitration for Sport announced their ruling early this morning. The World's Bianca Hillier is here with the details. Welcome, Bianca.
Hi, Marco.
Did the court say how they arrived at this ruling?
They gave some insight into the process. They pointed to Valieva's age as one reason why she'll be allowed to compete. At just 15 years old, they say she is a protected person under World Anti-Doping Agency rules, and they say they did consider the fairness of all athletes in this ruling. But in a video statement, the court's Director General, Matthew Reeb, said this case has exceptional circumstances.
The CAS panel is well aware of the rule on mandatory provisional suspensions, but has determined that the athlete should benefit from the following exceptional circumstances. In particular, the panel considered that preventing the athlete to compete at the Olympic Games would cause her irreparable harm.
And Marco, Valieva is not wasting any time. She was seen at a practice session in Beijing just 30 minutes after the ruling came down.
Okay, so tomorrow we'll see her on the ice. What about the gold medal, though, that she and her team earned last week? Will they get to keep that?
So that is still a bit up in the air, but for now, the International Olympic Committee says the medal ceremony will only happen when Valieva's case is completed, because they say it would not be appropriate to hold it and award medals with an ongoing case. And of course, Valieva has a chance to medal again this week in the women's singles event. Here's IOC spokesperson Mark Adams.
Should Ms. Valieva finish amongst the top three competitors in the women's single skating competition, no flower ceremony and no medal ceremony will take place during the Olympic Winter Games, Beijing 2022.
Wow, so no ceremony? It won't happen at all? Do you get your medal at a later date or something?
Something like that. It won't happen during these games. So to be clear, if Valieva earns one of those top three spots, nobody will step onto the podium. And the IOC says a dignified ceremony will happen once the case is cleared, but there's been no timeline given for that larger process.
So that is the ruling. Kind of extraordinary. What's been the reaction to it?
Yeah, as you can imagine, big reaction to this. The U.S. and Canadian Olympic committees have said they are disappointed with the ruling. And disappointed might be a major understatement here, because if you think about it, you know, the medal ceremony is not just a photo op. It's what these athletes have been working for their whole lives, to get that gold medal moment and be recognized for their achievements. And now they won't get it during these games when, you know, they have the spotlight of the world. What's more, Global Athlete, an international athlete advocacy group, said in a statement that the fact that a 15-year-old has a performance-enhancing drug in her system is, quote, evidence of abuse of a minor. Mm. I spoke with the group's director general, Rob Kuehler, about this. Now, he thinks Valieva should be held accountable and not be allowed to compete this week. But because of her age and Russia's history with state-sponsored doping, he says it's important to zoom out and understand the wider context.
Every Russian athlete that we've spoken to, both former, current, and whistleblowers, have told us that if you are in the system, you're part of the system. If you're not, you're out. And being part of the system may require you to take performance-enhancing substance. And at the age of 15 years old, the entourage surrounding Camilla must pay a severe price. And there must be a robust investigation to determine what happened.
So, Bianca, to that point, is there going to be more of an investigation? What is the next step?
Yeah, a few agencies have already said they plan to investigate Valieva's team for their possible involvement in all of this. That includes her coaches, trainers, and medical staff. Because it's important to remember, nobody, including Valieva, has been cleared of violating anti-doping rules yet. The only thing that was determined in this ruling was that, according to the court, Valieva should still be able to compete at the games. The court did not look at how the drug ended up in her system or why it took so long for the positive result to come to light. And as we said, those answers could take months to sort out.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers the Olympics for us. Bianca, thanks very much for this.
Thank you, Marco.
Scientists in Europe are celebrating a breakthrough in fusion energy production. While fusion is still decades away from becoming an everyday energy source, JET Laboratory, that's Joint European Torus, is counting it as an important step forward. They produce enough energy in 5 seconds to boil 60 kettles worth of water. That far surpassed the previous world record. For more, I'm joined by Tony Donnet, who is CEO of Eurofusion, the collaboration that funds and coordinates this research in Europe. He's in Ghent in Belgium. Every few years or so, Tony, it feels like fusion technology experiences another breakthrough, but we're always at least a decade down the road from it being practical, it seems. How big of a deal is this breakthrough?
Well, this is a very important one. I would say it's the culmination of 15 years of work. Really, the very exciting thing is that in the 5 seconds, we can see many details. Since 1997, when we did the first experiments, we have been working on models, but we never could validate them. So this was the first time we could do these experiments. And the exciting thing is that we really got out what we had expected. That's always a surprise. Science is, well, you never know beforehand whether it works, but this time it worked. And it really lays out a path for the next generation of machines.
Remind us how fusion energy works, and maybe you can contrast it with fission, which is what happens at a nuclear reactor, right?
Yeah, that's right. Fusion is exactly the opposite as fission. So fusion is the energy of the sun and the stars. And what happens in fusion is that you have very light nuclei, typically hydrogen nuclei, which you merge together, you fuse them. But to do that, you need very high temperatures. And to do it on Earth, we need temperatures which are higher than in the sun. So in our reactor in JET, we achieve typically 150 million degrees. And at that very high temperature, hydrogen atoms which meet each other, which collide with each other, might smash into each other and form helium.
Yes, so 150 million degrees. That does kind of equal the sun or a star, right?
It's 10 times the temperature in the sun.
Wow. What happens in a nuclear reactor with fission?
With fission, you take a very heavy nucleus like uranium, plutonium, you shoot neutrons on it, and the nucleus splits in parts. And then also you create a lot of energy. But we know that nuclear fission has a number of negative effects. One is the radioactive products. They are really long-lived. You have the possibility of a meltdown. And these are all effects we don't have in fission. So that's why we are doing so our best, because it's a CO2-free energy source, so it's good for the climate. The fuel is everywhere available. It's just very difficult to create these high temperatures and get the process going. But we are getting there in small steps.
Climate scientists, Tony, say we need to transition off of oil, gas, and coal very quickly to avert the worst impacts of climate change, as in like the next decade or two. Is fusion going to be too late in the game to help out?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Fusion will not be there, let's say, to have a major role in the energy transition before 2050. The advantages of fusion is that the geological or geographical footprint is very small. And because it's such a safe energy source, you can also have the fusion plants very close to densely populated centers, mega cities, industrialized areas. So in that sense, I think there's still a need for fusion. I'm not completely sure whether we can do the energy transition only with renewables. I'm really convinced that we cannot do anything with any single energy source. I don't believe that fusion will be the, let's say, the holy grail and the final solution for everything. I think fusion should be part of the future energy mix, as will be wind and solar. And all these energy sources together need to create a sustainable future for mankind.
Tony Donnet is CEO of Eurofusion, a collaboration that funds and directs European research into fusion energy. He's been speaking with us from Ghent, Belgium. Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, good news in the fight against elephant poaching. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Each year, it's estimated that poachers traffic around 500 tons of illegal ivory, and for decades, elephants have paid the price with their lives. Most of the ivory goes from Africa to Asia. Law enforcement intercepts only about 10% of that, which means it's hard to build legal cases against the criminals responsible. Scientists are onto something, though, that might help. Here's the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
Shipments of poached elephant tusks leave ports across Africa and then scatter through global shipping networks. African Wildlife Foundation CEO Kadi Sibunya says that makes it hard to stop smugglers.
It's a challenge for us who work in Africa because the markets are outside Africa. It requires a global solution.
In recent years, DNA testing has proven helpful to law enforcement officials. They can link shipments containing tusks from the same animal to help build criminal cases against traffickers. Now, the conservation biologist behind those efforts, Samuel Wasser from the University of Washington, is taking that DNA research a step further.
We could look at tusks from close relatives that are found in separate shipments.
Meaning parents and offspring or sibling elephants.
When we did that, it was astounding what we found.
The findings were published today in the journal Nature Human Behavior. Wasser and his co-authors analyzed more than 4,000 elephant tusks from 49 ivory seizures going back to 2002.
Literally, we had dozens of shipments that were tightly connected by multiple familial matches.
Meaning that the same elephant herds are being targeted by poachers again and again. DNA shows that elephants whose tusks were seized in 2015 in Singapore were closely related to elephants whose tusks ended up in 24 other shipments. When Wasser mapped out all of those connections,
it's just this spider web.
What this spider web of connections means, Wasser told reporters, is that these shipments are being moved by just a few tightly connected criminal networks.
There could be as few as three big criminal organizations that are involved.
The African Wildlife Foundation's Kadi Sibunya says that's not a surprise. It takes years to build up a smuggling network, so there are relatively few big traffickers.
It's not so much that some of these people are not known to governments or to Interpol or to the judiciary. No, they are known. The hard part has been, where is the evidence?
That's where new DNA testing techniques can help, Sibunya says. By linking one seized shipment to lots of others, prosecutors can build more evidence of larger crimes committed by global crime syndicates.
A lot of the cases we've lost, there's no evidence. You can't really connect the trail to the individuals. And what this research has done, it really is another layer that can help us in evidence.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security partially funded the DNA research published today. DHS criminal investigator John Brown told reporters these methods are already being used to go after ivory traffickers.
This collaborative effort has been paramount to successful engagement across international boundaries to combat the illicit trade in wildlife.
Brown wouldn't comment on specific cases, but he said that DNA evidence is being used in several ongoing investigations. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The pandemic has taken a severe toll on children in West Africa. It's made them more vulnerable to violence, exploitation, and assaults. If a child is a victim of such things and they live in Ghana, they have to pay for medical exams to initiate a police investigation, which often prevents the poor from seeking justice. But as Ridwan Karimdini Osman in Ghana explains, there's a new movement to fix this. And a quick warning, this story contains descriptions of assault, which might not be appropriate for everyone around you. Please take care while listening.
Kisi is a fishing community in the central region of Ghana. Here, the men man the boats while the business is run by women. Majority of residents live on less than $2 a day. In this community, I meet this 16-year-old whom I would like to identify by her first name, Georgina, due to the stigma connected to sexual assault in Ghana. In front of a room made of clay with thatched roofing, she sits with her chin buried in her palm. Almost 2 years ago, amid COVID-19 lockdown in Ghana, she was assaulted by someone she thought meant well.
In
2020, when the lockdown was imposed, schools were shut, so I was home. Times were really tough, and even food to eat was hard to come by. The day I met the man, I was very hungry, and he offered to buy me food. After that, he invited me into his room, pounced on me, and had sex with me.
Georgina says after reporting the case at the police station, she was told to proceed to hospital for a medical report. And that was where she realized getting justice was a distant mirage. At the hospital, I was in so much pain. I remember the doctor telling my mother the medical report will cost 550 Ghana cedis, but we didn't have the money, and so we didn't pursue the case again. The Ghana Medical Association says doctors charge the equivalent of $125 to fill out police medical forms and about $300 for giving a medical opinion for legal purposes. Reports from the Domestic Violence and Victim Support Unit of the Ghana Police Service suggest that many of these rape and defilement cases occur in rural areas to vulnerable children of less privileged parents who find it difficult to bear the cost of initiating prosecution for justice to prevail. Georgina's mother, Grace Awachi, says the current arrangement is discriminatory and a travesty of justice.
Till date, it breaks my heart that the man who did this to my daughter is walking around scot-free because I couldn't pay for a medical form to prove he defiled my child. Why is it that only the rich get justice in this country?
Vera Elikem Awiye works with human rights NGO International Nice Ghana. She says the problem is common and sometimes her organization has to pay for medical reports for victims.
I really think that the government should do something about it. It's critical. It's very critical if we really want to develop as a country.
In Ghana, sexual assault is underreported due to social and cultural factors that silence victims. The police often lack capacity to effectively investigate cases which can take years to get to the courts. Community leaders often ask for out-of-court settlements and negotiate for culprits to pay compensation to victims' families. Francis Xavier Sosu is a human rights lawyer and a member of Ghana's parliament. He says nothing should stand in the way of punishing people who commit such barbaric acts.
Clearly, that is a practice that denies people of sexual assault of their right to be heard in court, to their right to be fairly treated by the state and to also protect them under the law.
Sosu says he's put together a draft legislation entitling victims to free medical care and reports. And if more cases are prosecuted, there would be more of a deterrent to future sexual assaults. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Ghana.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2021 fundraiser. Over 775 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Julie Promisel Cooper, Bill Corcoran, Judith Davidson, Lauren DeVore and Paul Jackson, Owen Demers, Stephen Densmore, Mariano Diaz, Elizabeth Edmonds, Catherine Essex, Catherine Fitzgibbon. While I'm not able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to the show. Russia appears on the brink of invading Ukraine, but Moscow insists there's still an off-ramp. One scenario, Finlandization, as in Finland's experience with the Soviet Union in the 1960s.
A small country is subdued, has to claim neutrality, and basically sacrifice its values.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Those truckers in Canada we were talking about earlier on the show, they've inspired a movement in Europe where a lot of people also feel that COVID restrictions have gone too far. The so-called European Freedom Convoy said it would send thousands of protesters from across Europe to Brussels today. It turned out to be more smoke than fire. Police in Brussels said several hundred people showed up, along with about 500 cars and camper vans. Perhaps stern warnings from authorities scared the protesters off, or maybe because more European nations are lifting COVID restrictions. In France, protesters have remained the most disruptive. You need a vaccination pass to participate in some of the joys of modern French life, like going to a pub or cafe, or taking a ride down the ski slopes. Reporter Rebecca Rossman in Paris spoke with protesters this weekend, making their way to Belgium, and filed this report.
Flanked with French, Canadian, and Quebec flags of solidarity, hundreds of people from across France defied a ban to meet on the Champs-Élysées over the weekend. Their rallying cry, Liberté.
Pour la liberté, déjà, pour les enfants, pour l'avenir.
55-year-old Giselle Mandana drove her RV all the way up from the southern city of Nice as part of the Convoi de la Liberté, or Freedom Convoy. She's been following the movement's whereabouts on the encrypted messaging app Telegram. While police stopped Mandana and other vehicles from blocking traffic on the Champs-Élysées, she said she planned to converge with other European convoys, including from the Netherlands and Portugal, in Brussels Monday. We've been dealing with all these restrictions for too long. We don't have a life anymore, says Mandana, who is unvaccinated. We're living under an authoritarian regime. What kind of life is this? Mandana is referring to France's vaccine pass, which requires people to show proof of vaccination to enter restaurants, bars, and other public venues. More than 90% of the French adult population has now received at least one dose of the vaccine, making the convoy a very small but vocal minority. Speaking on French television last week, European Affairs Minister Clément Beaune dismissed the movement.
C'est pas le convoi de la liberté, ce qu'on voit là. C'est le convoi de la honte et de l'égoïsme.
This isn't a convoy of freedom, but rather one of shame and selfishness, Beaune said, casting off its participants as a group of anti-vax conspiracy theorists. Some people compare them to the 2018 anti-establishment Yellow Vest protests, which at one point attracted more than 250,000 people across France. Jerome Rodriguez, a leading figure amongst the Yellow Vests, has also played a key role in the Convoi de la Liberté. French President Emmanuel Macron eventually made some concessions to the Yellow Vests, including raising the minimum wage and scrapping a planned fuel tax. But many of the protesters I spoke to over the weekend say they're still fed up with Macron. Mr. Macron is a dictator, says Maris, a 76-year-old retired nurse who accused the president of taking away people's freedoms. But with the majority of the French population fully vaccinated and COVID-19 restrictions beginning to loosen across Europe, the convoy's momentum may be short-lived. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
The signals that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine are not trending in the right direction, according to many diplomats. Russian troops and warships along the Ukrainian border suggest something could happen soon. But Moscow says a diplomatic resolution to the conflict is still possible. There's also an old term that's come back into use, a word that may offer a possible way forward for Ukraine, Finlandization. To talk about that, we have the former Prime Minister of Finland, Alexander Stubb, with us. What does the term Finlandization mean in diplomatic circles, Alexander?
Finlandization is a term from the 1960s, which basically says that a small country has to remain neutral, it has to sacrifice its values in order for it to be able to survive next to a bigger power, such as the Soviet Union. That is the reason why we in Finland do not like the term at all.
So it sounds like for Finns, Finlandization is somewhat condescending. I mean, how do you remember this era of Finnish history and politics? How did it shape Finland? And was there a plus side to Finlandization?
I see very few plus sides. It was very much a term whereby, you know, we weren't able to do the things that we wanted to do. So for instance, in the 1970s, we wanted to join the European Free Trade Association, EFTA, but we couldn't. And that was because of, you know, Soviet imposition, if you will. So we ended up doing this so-called Finn-EFTA agreement. In the 1980s, we wanted to join the Council of Europe, which should be, you know, pretty basic stuff. But we couldn't do it until later in the 1980s. So, you know, I don't remember the whole term or the whole time very positively. In 1989 and onwards, I felt this sort of innate feeling of freedom that finally we're able to do what we want to. And immediately we filed
for membership in the European Union, and actually then became close partners with NATO. So fortunately, that time in Finnish history is over.
Back to the question, though, was there a plus side to kind of walking this fine line between the West and Moscow?
Yeah, I guess there was an element of security and there was an element of survival. But at the same time, we really had to subdue the firm values that we believed in. And in that sense, I have, you know, a very hard time looking at the positives of it. And on top of that, you know, we had a president, Urho Kekkonen, who was very respected at the time, and may he rest in peace. But the truth is that his period was extended. So the guy was president for the better part of 25 years. And, you know, you can really question in a democracy if you have two sort of clear times in which or clear mandates of a presidency, is it okay just to go ahead and extend it? So, you know, for me, Finlandization is really, unfortunately, something very negative.
Well, today Finland is a pro-Western nation. It's also not part of NATO, and the current prime minister says it's unlikely to join. I wonder what you think about the Finlandization middle ground approach and whether it could work right now for Ukraine.
You can't really compare it. Now, on NATO, if I may clarify a little bit, there are three ways to approach it. One is you say, no, we're not going to join. Two is you say, we're going to join. Three is what we do. We have a so-called NATO option. So it's basically a threat to say that we will join if there is more intimidation. On top of that, if I may add, we are a very close NATO partner, part of the NATO Council. And on top of that, we are actually more NATO compatible than most of the NATO member states. In the early 1990s, we bought 64 F-18s, and now we've just purchased 64 F-35s from the US. So I don't think that there's any question on which side of the football team we are.
Do you have a sense as to whether Putin sees the world and the symbolism of Ukraine to Russia history and identity as black and white, or could he support this middle ground if Ukraine were to take the Finnish approach?
Well, again, you know, we're working here against the premise of a term which is from the past, which I do not like and which I don't think will work for anyone else. Now, do I believe that diplomatic negotiations and discussion is the way out of this impasse? Yes. Does anyone know what Putin is going to do? No, not necessarily. I myself was foreign minister of Finland and chairman of the OSCE in August 2008 when Russia attacked Georgia. That conflict ended with a ceasefire agreement in 5 days, but a frozen conflict in both South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And obviously, we do not want things to escalate that far. But unfortunately, the way in which Russia is working at the moment is that it creates so-called frozen conflicts. So we're not looking at what I would call, you know, full-scale war. I think what Russia is doing is using all the clubs in the bag and basically weaponizing everything that's possible. And that means information, that means energy, that means cyber attacks. So, you know, my guess is that there will not be a full-scale attack, but probably smaller intimidations.
Alexander, how do you think a Russian invasion of Ukraine, if that were to happen, would change Europe and its politics? And where do you think that would put Finland?
Finland is steadfastly a part of the West. Remember, you know, we are one of the most prosperous nations in the world. We are members of the European Union. We are partners of NATO. We hold a certain set of values, which traditional Western values. The second is what we're seeing in Finland at the moment is an increase in support for NATO membership. And the shift is actually quite remarkable in the sense that we've been hovering pretty steadily, 20% in favor of membership and 50% opposing membership. There's a clear move downwards of opposition to below 40 and upwards of support to above 30. So, you know, there is movement. The more Russia intimidates, the more Finland is moving towards NATO membership.
Alexander Stubb is a former prime minister and former foreign minister of Finland. He's currently the director of and professor at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. Alexander, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Wordle, the freakishly addictive online word game, has been captivating millions of people for 3 months now. I'm hooked. It's skyrocketing popularity, inspired versions of the game in other languages, also versions that are swear words only, even a numbers-based version that's mathematic equations instead of letters. And now we introduce you to yet another spinoff, one near and dear to our hearts here at The World. The game is called World Dull. Yeah, not easy to say, World Dull. And not easy to play either. World Dull gives you the shape of a country, just the outline, no reference point on a map. Then you have five chances to guess what country it is. World Dull will give you feedback like your guess is 2,300 miles off and an arrow pointing you in the right direction. My first attempt was not pretty, but I am determined to get good at this one too. You can find the link to the game on our Twitter feed, at The World, and tweet us your results so we can see how you do. For months now, the U.S. has had its finger firmly pressed down on a crucial Taliban pressure point, $7 billion in assets at Afghanistan's central bank. Much of the money is held by American financial institutions, which means it's possible for the U.S. to freeze it, seize it, or divert it. Last Friday, President Biden signed an executive order doing just that. Some of that money is earmarked for humanitarian aid in Afghanistan. Other funds may go to families of 9/11 victims. Scott Anderson is a senior editor and general counsel at Lawfare and is going to help us sort through all of this. Scott, when the U.S. government goes after foreign assets like this, is there anything, legally speaking, that can be done to stop them?
There certainly is. When you have assets in which a U.S. citizen has an interest, in which somebody with has certain due process rights, or even foreign entities that have a presence in the United States, they can challenge these constitutionally. But for the most part, courts have been willing to uphold executive branch actions, particularly under a particular law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is the basis for the vast majority of economic sanctions that the president applies. Maybe it's worth clarifying exactly what Biden's order does, essentially. Again, there were about $7 billion of central bank, Afghan central bank assets in the United States. What the order does is it takes all those assets, puts it in a Bank of New York, and it blocks any sort of transactions involving them. That means all these plaintiffs that have judgments that they're trying to enforce against those assets won't immediately be able to do so, even if nobody shows up to defend those assets, if the Afghan central bank doesn't have anyone to represent it in court, which is a possibility. No one's really stood up to represent them so far, primarily because the Taliban has chosen not to appear in court and defend itself. There's a lot of chaos around who actually controls those assets.
And what is the overall goal of the U.S. going after these funds? How is it targeting the Taliban regime? Or is that not the goal?
That's definitely the goal of a lot of U.S. policies, in that the United States has maintained economic sanctions against the Taliban really since the 1990s, fairly consistently. This latest measure actually doesn't really advance that particular policy goal, in part because the assets at issue here are actually the assets of the Central Bank of Afghanistan. And the extent to which they are related to the Taliban is in dispute. The United States doesn't recognize the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan, nor do any other foreign governments, to my knowledge, at this stage. And so their view is that these are the assets of the Central Bank of Afghanistan, of the state of Afghanistan. And until they has a government, it's actually not entirely clear who can control them.
Some of the families of the victims of 9/11 have sued in U.S. courts seeking compensation from the Afghan Central Bank. So how does Biden's executive order impact those efforts?
What it does essentially is it says the asset that you have already sued over, which are the central bank assets of Afghanistan being held in New York Federal Reserve Bank, those assets are going to stay in place and you're going to be able to continue to sue over them. So it actually doesn't affect anything there. The one thing it does affect is that at least one group of plaintiffs was trying to attach all $7 billion, saying that they have a $7 billion claim. And the United States is saying, and I think has suggested in various filings, that in fact, the legal claim to all $7 billion is probably not there.
So does that imply that if the U.S. eventually likes what it's seeing from the Taliban, it can loosen this order that Biden signed?
It could, although it's pretty strongly signaled right now that it doesn't have any intention of doing so. At the same time, the Biden administration has said, we're going to take $3.5 billion of this about $7 billion, about half, and we're going to commit that to providing humanitarian assistance. We're putting that into a separate account. What I take this as a sign of them doing is that they are actually trying to say, we understand there are these legal proceedings going forward regarding these assets, but those processes should not be allowed to hold up the use of all of these assets potentially for some Afghan benefit.
Well, to that point, our reporter Shirin Jafari spoke with Obaidullah Bahir, a lecturer at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul, about the asset diversion from the central bank. And what he says is that seizing this money actually makes the current crisis worse.
Afghans were not involved in the plotting or execution of 9/11. Afghans, even if the Taliban were complicit, should not mean that the Afghan population is made to pay and suffer for a decision that the Taliban made. The Federal Reserves do not belong to a government, they belong to the people.
Scott Anderson, legally speaking, is there a distinction between the people of Afghanistan and the government of Afghanistan when it comes to this money?
There absolutely is. And that is still a barrier that these various plaintiffs are going to have to overcome before they're actually able to seize any of this money. They're going to have to go into court and say, in fact, this money is now does now belong to the Taliban, is not covered by any sovereign immunities that are in place, and can be attached by us. I think that's actually a high bar. I'm not sure any of these plaintiffs are actually going to be able to get these assets in the near term, but they might get some of them. That whole legal process was already underway before the Biden administration's actions and largely takes place out of the Biden administration's controls.
I mean, there is a humanitarian crisis right now in Afghanistan. Could those resources arrive before more people encounter even worse conditions this winter?
The sad truth is that the Biden administration has made clear that precisely because there is this existing litigation around these assets and it needs to get court sign-off before it's able to channel even the $3.5 billion it is segregating out for the benefit of the Afghan people. That's really unfortunate and tragic. I'm not sure that I see a route by which the Biden administration could legally have made this available faster, given the legal issues and the litigation interests involved.
Scott Anderson is a senior editor and general counsel at Lawfare, which covers the intersection of law and national security. Scott, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Later this month in Nairobi, Kenya, the United Nations kicks off a big environmental conference. Representatives from around the globe will be talking about their most pressing concerns. In Kenya itself, green advocates are sounding the alarm over a reversal of environmental protections, legislation they say would endanger Kenya's forests. The World's Halima Gikandi in Nairobi reports from one such place right in the metropolis where she lives.
I'm walking in the Ngong Forest. And I really cannot believe I'm in Nairobi. It's so green here, it's so lush, there are so many animals. I've seen a bunch of monkeys, a bunch of birds, and the air is so fresh here, which normally isn't the case in most parts of this city. But this is one of the very few green spaces in Nairobi, and it's a place that conservationists are telling me is under threat due to a new bill that's going to be heard in Parliament.
At the forest, I meet with Simon Nganga. He's the vice chairman of the Ngong Road Forest Association.
People use the forest in many ways. There are those who rely on the forest for their source of livelihood. There are communities around that have relied on the forest for all their lives.
People come to collect wood for fuel, herbs for medicine, and there's a beekeeping operation here for honey. Simon Nganga has been working for years to protect forests like these. He says in the past, they were vulnerable to land grabbing. A forest protection law passed in 2005 helped stop illegal acquisition of public forest lands. That made a big difference, Nganga says.
There has not been any successful acquisition, not legally at least. So we can see the law has really worked to protect the boundaries of the forests.
The law currently requires that any proposed changes to public forest boundaries go through the Kenya Forest Service, or KFS. But a new proposal in Parliament would drop that requirement and allow individuals to petition lawmakers directly instead. That has Nganga worried.
If you allow now individuals to decide or to alter boundaries and eventually maybe hive or split the forest or maybe give it out to private individuals, we are going to lose it. We are going to lose that very precious indigenous resource.
Environmental groups are lobbying hard against the proposed changes to the forest law. Many accuse politicians of trying to make it easier for themselves to grab land. I spoke with Nixon Courier. He's a member of parliament in Nairobi. The Ngong Forest falls under his constituency.
The amendment is proposing a deletion of a section of the statute, the forest bill, to align it to the Article 119 of the Constitution.
That article says any person would have the right to petition parliament on any issue. Courier adds that the Kenya Forest Service has been slow in handling land disputes. That's been hurting some of his constituents.
Because of the failure of KFS to solve those matters, that's when now some Kenyans are now proposing amendments to the law to make it now so that it can allow them to sort the mess that KFS cannot sort.
Sorting out the legal mess for people already living on forest lands needs to happen, Courier says, but this proposed legislation is not the answer, and he's not supporting it.
Because it will open a Pandora's box that it can be used by, let me use the word, people who are against environmental conservation to now tamper with the boundaries of the forest. And that is why I oppose it.
Back at Ngong Forest, I meet with Miriam Sembo, who's here to enjoy the park with her son. He's on his bike.
It's a safe space for me to come here on a daily because, you know, with us living in apartments and everything, you don't get to have big spaces where you can run around, where he can run around. So for me, this place is very sentimental.
Sembo says she worries that the proposed changes to the law protecting forests would put places like this in jeopardy. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Catch up with some of the latest news stories from our reporters around the globe, from Daniel Offman's coverage in Ukraine about how residents in Kiev are preparing for a possible war with Russia, to Ashley Westerman in the Philippines covering the kickoff of the election campaign there. Those stories and more on our website, theworld.org. It's a familiar melody, especially for figure skating fans. This year, Ravel's Bolero accompanies no fewer than three routines at the Beijing Olympics. Colleen Phelps of Louisville Public Media clues us in as to why.
Kamila Valieva of the Russian Olympic Committee became the first woman to land a quad jump at the Olympics. The soundtrack was Bolero. Japan's Shoma Uno and Boyang Jin of China skated to it as well. Of course, in 1984, English ice dancers Jane Torval and Christopher Dean made history with it. Their routine remains a gold standard for artistry, with near-perfect scores. Maurice Ravel's Bolero wasn't universally loved right away. An audience member is reported to have shouted, "Rubbish! Rubbish!" at the 1928 premiere. A later critic called it the most insolent monstrosity ever perpetuated in the history of music. It's also not really a bolero. It doesn't qualify as that dance form. Ravel said the repetitive melody invokes a factory. Bolero never lacks drama. Valieva's performance is now under review for substance use, and Torval and Dean had to skirt the rules because the edited version of the music was too long. They stayed on their knees at the opening to squeeze 18 extra seconds of time into their sensual skate. So what is it about these 15 minutes of repetition that works so well on the ice? It's a lot of contained energy for something with lifts and jumps. There are also other greatest hits in figure skating. Bolero doesn't run like Carmen, it doesn't die like Swan Lake, and it doesn't cry like the Moonlight Sonata. But Bolero does have driving rhythm, sinewy melody, and steady, dramatic growth. Plus, with all the required skills, blades, and even the Zambonis, one could imagine the mechanically minded Ravel enjoying seeing the piece put on ice, even with a little drama slowly burning underneath. For The World, I'm Colleen Phelps.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.